Doctor, I enjoy the prospects for today's discussion because really it comes out of our mail and one of the most common questions you get asked in the mail. As a matter of fact, if I had to kind of go out on a limb here and take a guess, I would say that the most common question you're asked about parenthood has to do with the subject of the day, which will be sibling rivalry, and comes out of a letter that looks like it was written by somebody who is totally exhausted and just can hardly cope.
Gil, that not only comes out of our mail, but it comes out of my experience and probably yours too, because all of us in the kind of urban industrialized society that America has become are going so fast and we're so worn out and so exhausted and there's so many stresses on us, so many pressures on our time. And by the time you change the tires on the car or fix the leak in the roof or you pay your taxes and do your job and work for the church and reach out to those in need and do all the things that relate to your own family, there's just absolutely nothing left. And sometimes it seems that every day is just jam-packed to the hilt. We put so much in the bag, and that drains us emotionally and drains us physically. And I think definitely sets up problems and conflicts between us and our children and how we handle the minor frustrations of the day, sibling rivalry being one of those things.
As you know, we have three kids, one of whom is an infant, and that's a surefire way to inject a little exhaustion into your schedule to have a baby around the house.
Gil, of all the things that I wrote in my book, What Wives Wish Their Husbands Knew About Women, I think the story that I've probably gotten more a positive reaction from is relating to when Ryan was a baby. He's now 12, but I can still remember some of the things you're probably going through now, or at least your wife is. But Ryan was 4 months of age at this time, and Shirley brought him in the morning, and she put him up on the bathinet to change his diapers. She got the diapers off, and he chose that moment to make like a fountain, and he wet down the wall and the floor and a little bit on Shirley and everything else. And so she went to work, and she cleaned all that up, and she hadn't any more than gotten it done until the telephone rang. And Shirley put Ryan on the floor so he couldn't get hurt, and she ran to pick up the telephone. She only talked for a moment or two, but when she came back, Ryan had had a sudden attack of projectile diarrhea and had machine-gunned his crib and the wall and the floor and himself and just pretty well wrecked the whole room. And Shirley mopped her brow and went to work, and she cleaned all that up, disinfected the whole room, deodorized everything, took Ryan, put him in tub and cleaned him all up and put beautiful, clean-smelling clothes on him and got him all taken care of and put him over her shoulder and patted him on the back, and he threw up at that moment down her neck and it ran down her back. And all of this in a period of about 2 hours in the morning. She had done not one thing but clean up after that kid. Add that to the stresses of her day, which were already pretty heavy. And needless to say, I took her out to dinner that night when I came home.
I got home the other day and walked in and heard Todd crying and walked into the family room. And our 9-year-old was rocking him and our 12-year-old was doing homework at the table, and Ruth was nowhere in sight. And the first words out of my 9-year-old's mouth were, "Wake Mommy up, you know, I can't stand Todd anymore." And I went upstairs, and Ruth had been asleep for 2 hours. She just totally exhausted.
Worn out.
And what had started with a nap for Todd and Ruth had ended up with the baby being awake and the girls taking care of him. It is just plain exhaustion. It's like 18, 20 hours a day.
Yeah, and it's not just for the parents of infants and toddlers either, because there is a syndrome now called parent burnout. In fact, there's a book on that subject written by a man named Dr. Procaccini, I think that's the way he pronounces his name, and a colleague, Dr. Mark Kiefeber, who's a psychologist. And they wrote about the characteristics that set up parent burnout. It's not just physical exhaustion, but it's emotional exhaustion as well. And it occurs for parents who especially care about their children. That's why it's highly relevant on a program of this nature. People don't listen to this program unless they care about their families and about their kids. And according to these authors, if you're a responsible type, a kind of an idealistic and a highly motivated person, you can get it. You can get this parent burnout. In other words, in order to be burned out, you have to be on fire. And so it's for the compulsive parent that can fall into this trap. I have an article here on this subject that appeared first in the Baltimore Evening Sun. And they said the modern syndrome, recognized in earlier days simply as exhaustion, strikes when excessive demands are placed on a person's strength, energy, and resources. Dr. Pocaccini then described the malady as a downward drift toward physical, emotional, and in some cases spiritual exhaustion, usually resulting from chronic high stress and perceived high responsibility. It's a condition they call parent burnout. Now, these are the common feelings that are reported by the parent who has this problem. They feel they're not able to be good parents. They feel that their children are demanding more than they can give to them. They feel that they dislike their children and that their kids are burdensome to them. Gil, you remember when I was in Seattle for the citywide seminar a while back and I faced a press conference the next morning. There were a couple of television cameras there and some radio microphones and then five or six reporters. And you may recall that one of the reporters made a very important comment. She said, "I'm a single mother and I have a four-year-old daughter and I can't stand her. I can't stand to be with her." Now, that is characteristic of a person here, a single mother. She's involved in a career. She's trying to progress. She's trying to compete. She's trying to earn a living. And she comes home tired, and this kid is making demands of her, as children will do. They do not fit into that kind of to-do list very well. And what she's saying is, "I'm exhausted, and this kid is just an additional drain on my resources." That's what they're talking about here. Another characteristic of it is guilt, which leads to defensiveness, which in turn leads to a whole group of other problems. Then there's physical exhaustion and the feeling that the home life is just one more hassle. And last, but most important, that their lives are completely out of control and that the children are running them. Gil, this especially applies again to that single parent that we were just talking about. After that Seattle seminar, 15,000 people that were there, and it was not possible for us to interact with more than just a very few of them. But one of the people who was there came down, fought their way through the crowd, and got a hold of Shirley, my wife, and she was crying. And she grabbed her and she said, "You must tell your husband something for me." And Shirley said, "What is it?" And she said, "Tell him he's got to help us single parents. He's got to help us." And she was just crying. And what she was reflecting is this kind of emotional and physical and spiritual exhaustion that comes from all the demands that modern life places on us, plus what used to be a full-time responsibility of raising children.
I don't know how to put this into words, but I'll tell you, it also is different in different parts of the country. We used to live in the Midwest, and all that you hear about the Midwest versus Southern California is true in this regard. Life moves at a slower pace, and ever since we moved out here, I've been trying to put a handle on how to explain to relatives and my parents back east what the difference is. But all you can say is life just rolls from morning till evening, and there's always something, and even the most committed of us who have seen your third film and your film series, and we've written off all the insignificant priorities and given ourselves to our families, are just racing and going all the time.
People who follow us consistently and listen to what we say on the radio and listen to what we write might get weary with this message, but I see it as so basic that the kind of stresses that just living, just staying alive, earning a living, keeping up with the junk that we buy, raising kids in a shockwave world, and then you throw in the unexpected, the death of a parent, or a financial reverse, or physical illness in the mother or father or in the child, and there's no reserve. There's no resource left to draw on, and people just collapse emotionally.
And again, the technical term, I guess, from what you're sharing with us, that some professionals are giving to all of this is parent burnout.
Yes, and the article, again, that I was referring to is titled The Five Stages of Parental Burnout. And I think it's interesting to look at these very quickly. We started out today to talk about sibling rivalry, but this is part of it, because there's nothing much more stressful when you're exhausted than two kids taking apart one another emotionally and bickering and scratching and clawing and hurting one another and hitting one another. And, that has a way of just wearing a parent down to the point that when you're already depleted, you turn and you do something that you wish you hadn't. Whether it be child abuse or whether it just be verbal abuse, it does happen. But these are the five stages. Let me go through them very quickly. The first is on the physiological level, when people begin to feel tired, drained, and they may develop physical ailments. The physiological level. Now, that occurs first. The theme of what the authors are saying is that these are progressive. You go from one to the other. Second is on the social level, when people become irritable, difficult to deal with. At this point, parents may begin to avoid people not wanting social interaction. So your social life stops. You don't want to go out with anybody. You don't have anything left. I mean, it's just too much trouble to get dressed and go out. So you stay home. And then third is the intellectual level, when the burnout starts to affect the mind. The person is tired of thinking, and sometimes it begins to show up in difficulty in concentration. Then the fourth is a psycho-emotional level, where the person begins to perceive himself or herself as always meeting someone else's needs and then beginning to resent that. Another symptom is a strong desire to be alone. At this stage, according to the researchers, it is not rare to see people begin to depend on alcohol and other drugs to calm themselves. And then finally, stage five is the introspective level, where the person begins to question his own value system. He or she becomes less willing to contribute to others. Is it going to lead to anything? In other words, they're saying, you know, I just want to think of myself. I don't want to give to anybody else. It's not going to give me anything in return. You start becoming very selfish. And at this stage, something has to give. I think, Gil, what often gives is the physical body. I think at that point you compound all your problems with some kind of disease frequently, because the human body was not made to live under that kind of 7-day-a-week stress.
I think all of us find ourselves either to a greater degree or lesser degree in those words you're describing. I don't know how seriously I feel about it, but I sure feel exhausted and to some extent burned out at times. What kinds of recommendations do these authors make if you find yourself there?
Well, it isn't realistic for them to say that we change our entire lifestyle, because you have to change the culture to do that. But they do make some rather practical suggestions. Now, I haven't read their book. There could be unchristian things in that book. So before people run out and buy it, they ought to at least pick it up and look at it to see what's in it. This article that I have in front of me sounds good, however. And though it's rather brief, they do make the recommendation that people sit down and do what they call a time and energy audit. And you do that by beginning to list what you care about, what things are important with regard to your children. If that's where the stress is coming from, list what you want to do. For a Christian, number one, above all else, is to teach him to love the Lord and teach him what you believe, transfer your values to him, and prepare him for a life of service to God and his fellow man. That's got to be number one. And then you come on down the row. You want the best for him intellectually, and you want the best for him physically, and you get even more specific than that in terms of whether if he's a little older child, you're getting him ready for a college education or a happy marriage or financial security or whatever it is that you're hoping to do with him. Then you devote your energies primarily to the number one item on the priority list and work your way down. And when the time and energy's gone, that's as far as you go. You know, it sounds good on paper. I know, and it'll be very, very difficult to implement. But at least there's a target there to shoot at.
I have the same feeling hearing that I do after I see your film on Christian fathering, where you talk about priorities and all. And that is, the way to gain value from a suggestion like that is not to feel that you can make a decision at one point in your life that'll change the whole rest of your life. You're not going to do it. You know, 6 months from now, we're going to be in bad a shape as we are right now in terms of our pressures. But you need every once in a while to take a time and energy audit or see that film or whatever and just ask yourself, you know, this fall or this winter, am I doing it right? And then make some changes.
I need to take a time and energy audit every morning when I get out of bed.
It's that bad.
Like a bath. I know it's not going to be permanent. I'm going to get dirty again, but I still need the bath, you know. And we know we're going to need to think those thoughts again. Every time I see that third film on Christian fathering, it speaks to me again about whatever's going on in my life right then at that moment, because there is a constant pressure to get me to do more than I should do physically, emotionally, or as a father. And we have to resist that. But in the absence of that resistance, if we don't do that priority checking, you know, if we just let events take charge of us, then little things become frustrating.
All right. To get us into that, let me take a quote from a little booklet you wrote on this subject. You said, if American parents were asked to indicate the most irritating feature of child raising, I'm convinced that sibling rivalry would get their unanimous vote. Children are not content just to hate each other in private. They attack one another like miniature warriors, mobilizing their troops and probing for a weakness in the defensive line.
Gil, I'm sure if you polled parents, you would find that the conflict between their kids, which is so constant, you know, it's so daily, would be one of the most frustrating things they have to deal with. And unfortunately, they can't be like frogs. Frogs get to eat what bugs them, but parents can't handle sibling rivalry quite that easily. But that can be so frustrating when all that scratching and clawing and arguing and competing and attacking one another is taking place. I knew one family, Gil, where the older boy was sick with a cold, and he resented the fact that the younger one was able to go to school and he was well and healthy. And the older one actually, if you can believe this, he actually blew his nose on the mouthpiece of the younger child's musical instrument so he could spread the cheer around. That drives parents bananas.
It sure does. Now we're talking about real exhaustion. I heard my two girls going at it the other night, and I went to investigate what the problem was. And my oldest girl is just compulsive about neatness in the bathroom. Now, I don't know where that came from, because she's not compulsive about neatness other places. But the bathroom now has got to be spick and span. And the only problem is she shares it with her 9-year-old sister.
Ah, that's built for trouble.
They were up there arguing, and the gist of the argument was the younger girl was saying to the older girl, when you find my stuff on the floor of the bathroom, don't pile it in my sink. Let me ask you as a place to begin. Wouldn't you agree with me that sibling rivalry is only enhanced when your oldest kid drops into adolescence?
Yeah, that's an irritable age in the first place, you know. A 13, 14, 15-year-old is often angry at himself, angry at the peer pressure that he's under, angry at the pimples on his face, angry at his parents because they still hold power that he wants, and angry at just about everybody that irritates him and frustrates him, and that includes his younger siblings. So I think sibling rivalry probably does reach its peak when you have a youngster moving into the teen years, in the early teen years especially, and where he still has to have a lot of contact daily just to get through life with his younger brother or sister.
Yeah. Is it necessary for us to put up with that? Would you say, listen, folks, you're always going to have to deal with sibling rivalry if you've got kids?
I think that's just the way I'd say it. You do have to deal with sibling rivalry. You're not going to eliminate all of it, no matter what you do. And if you think that's a goal, then you're going to be even more frustrated. But I am convinced that we put up with more of it than we have to. And sometimes we even behave in ways that create more sibling rivalry just by our failure to understand some of the dynamic forces that are taking place.
There is a natural jealousy that exists between siblings that is the source of some of the rivalry, and it's important that parents don't inflame that.
I think that's what I was alluding to just a minute ago when I said sometimes we set off these problems ourselves and aren't even aware of it. Sibling rivalry is typically motivated by that green-eyed envy of one human being for another. It's a basic human flaw in character, and of course it's not at all new. Jealousy, this kind of envy, was responsible for the first murder on record when Cain killed Abel, and it's been going on ever since. Jacob and Esau had some classic confrontations as well, and it's just built into the human spirit.
You kind of referred to this in your book, Dr. Dobson Answers Your Questions. I noticed you were talking about sibling rivalry in this context, and that is parents can take steps to get the first child ready for the birth of the second child that may make a contribution toward reducing some of the rivalry.
Yeah, let's suppose you've got an older child. He's now 7 years of age, and you're going to have a baby. And so what we were told to do is to go to him and say, Johnny, we have loved you so much. You know, we have loved you so much that we want to bring another child into the world to share that love with. And Johnny would say, oh, that makes sense. I want to love him too. Well, it didn't work. Johnny still resented the invasion of this baby, just as a wife would resent it if a husband said to her, "Mary, I have loved you so much, I'm going to bring another woman in for us all to love."
Love around.
No chance, boy. There's hostility because she has been invaded. Her territory is now shared.
Let's get into some practical suggestions then. If there are ways that we can reduce the amount of sibling rivalry, what are they?
You talk about the baby long before he gets there. You allow him to pat his mommy's tummy, and he knows the baby is in there, and there's excitement over whether it's going to be a boy or a girl. And then you talk about what it's going to be like after he comes, and he's going to be absolutely helpless now. You should know that he won't be able to turn over, he won't be able to scratch his head, he won't be able to hold his own bottle. He can't talk for a long time, 2 or 3 years before he'll really be able to say very much to you. And that means that if we don't take care of him, if we don't do everything for him, he'll die. Because babies are like that. And that means it's going to take a lot of mommy's time. Now, you should be aware of that. It's going to look like that the baby is taking all my time. But it's because he's a baby. And he's going to grow up like you, and then it won't be that way anymore. And I want you to help me. Now, you can hold the bottle, and you can even hold the baby, depending on the age of the child. And you can help him get ready for this radical change that's going to take place, because a baby turns a family upside down, including his older brothers and sisters.
However you prepare for it, though, that is a time of tension, isn't it? There are 2, 3, 4-year-olds that will beat on the newborn child out of deep resentment.
Yeah, even if, as I said before, even if you lay that proper foundation, there will probably be some tension, and you need to watch for it, and you need to give that little speech again. The child forgets. He won't even remember that you gave it to him, perhaps. And if you see him pull off in the corner with his hands in his pockets while everybody is holding the baby, if you see him act out and become angry and throw things or overreact in situations that don't quite make sense, and you're not sure why is he being this way, it's because he's feeling something, and you need to deal with those feelings. If he tries to hit the baby or hurt the baby in some way, or he may just come right out and tell you about it. That actually happened in our family. We had attempted to lay the proper foundation with Danae, and we had explained all of that about Ryan, and she was 5 years old at the time. And we were at my parents' house on a Sunday afternoon, and everybody was so excited about the new baby, and they were cooing at Ryan and tickling him and having so much fun. And Danae was feeling replaced. You know, she was feeling things that we were not sensitive to. She didn't reveal it. She didn't throw things. She didn't become angry, but she was feeling it. And on the way home, when we were going back to our house, Ryan was asleep in his mother's arms, and Danae was in the back seat, but standing up between Shirley and me. And we were riding along, and all at once she said, "Daddy, can I tell you something?" Now, this is a 5-year-old speaking. I said, "Sure, Danae." She said, "I'm just talking, okay? I'm just talking. I don't mean anything bad. I'm just talking." And I said, "Sure, Danae, you can say what you're thinking." And she said, "Daddy, sometimes I wish little Ryan wasn't here." And you see, she gave us a clue as to what she was thinking and what she was feeling at that moment. So, of course, we immediately talked to her about how helpless he was and how dependent he was and how he was going to grow up and how she had been that way when she was that age. And we pulled her into the front seat, and we talked about what his development was going to be like and how much she was loved. And I think we helped her cope with those feelings. Unfortunately, most children will not verbalize those feelings. You've got to read them. Danae made our work easy for us by telling us what she was feeling. But you just need to watch the child and see what's going on, because if you are tuned into him, it isn't that difficult to feel with him, especially when you already know there's a predisposition to anger at that time.
It's not just a jealousy over material things, is it? You're talking about a jealousy over shared attention and shared affection and those things.
That's right. But now remember, in the suggestion that we began with, I said don't inflame that natural jealousy. The potential for it is there, but we can be sensitive to the circumstances that pit children against one another. And this takes us back to the content of my book, Hide or Seek, where I talk about the characteristics that are most highly prized in our society, the attributes that people evaluate human worth on, and those are the delicate nerves. Those are the exposed raw spots where you really have to be careful what you say or you will anger children at one another. And they are, again, first, physical attractiveness. Your idle comments as a parent that compare children on beauty or physical stature or anything having to do with the body is potential dynamite in the relationship between children. You know, if you just are sitting at the table and you say, you know, I think Paul's going to be considerably taller than John. I think he might have the potential of being a basketball player. Now, that's not an offensive thing. You haven't deliberately tried to cut John, but John looks at himself, and tomorrow he looks in the mirror, and then he looks at Paul, and he begins to resent the fact that Paul's going to have something that he doesn't, and somebody must think it's important, or why would they have said it? Or if you say, in the same context, you know, Paula is really getting pretty. Now, the very fact that you don't mention the beauty of another child, either older or younger, calls attention to the differences between them. Remember this, Gil. Comparison is the root of all inferiority. It is not how am I doing, it's how I'm doing compared to you. It's not how fast I run, it's who crosses the finish line first. It is not how smart I am, it's who got the best grades on a report card. And you see, in the conflict between Cain and Abel, it was not whether Cain's grain and what he was producing was adequate. It was how he felt God looked on that compared with Abel and what he brought for a sacrifice. It's when you realize that somebody is doing better, or somebody looks better, or somebody is more physically able than you are, that you begin to resent it. And if you're aware of this, you can avoid deliberately or even unconsciously antagonizing those sensitive spots between kids.
I suppose we have to acknowledge, though, that some of that jealousy can't be avoided even if we follow the principles you're talking about. I'm thinking about areas of conflict between my children that relate to differences that I can't overlook. For example, the difference in their age. I allow my oldest daughter to stay up later and take more liberties on the weekend than my youngest daughter, and that's a point of friction, and I get that standard, but Daddy, why not me? And there is only one answer, and that is because you're not as old as her. And that type of conflict between them just can't be avoided.
No, it can't. And so there will be some conflict. And that's what I said in the beginning. But you don't have to antagonize it by pointing out the things the child cannot do one thing about. You know, he's either good-looking or he's not. He's either, and I didn't mention this, but the second area is intelligence. He is either bright or he's not. He either does well in school or he doesn't. And the third area is athletic ability. You know, where one really does well in sports and the other is uncoordinated. Those three areas. Yeah. You don't have to make it worse. There are things, like you mentioned, where there are differences. And in fact, in the case of the age difference, I think we ought to give a little status to the older child, because along with that comes work and responsibility. And he washes the dishes when the other one is playing with the blocks on the floor. You know, those things go together. With that status comes more work, more responsibility, and a little more freedom.
All right, let me ask you another question about sibling rivalry that you deal with in your book, Dr. Dobson Answers Your Questions. Apparently somebody had asked you a question about competition, academic competition between kids, and whether that can be a manifestation of sibling rivalry. It had something to do with one youngster doing very well in school, one youngster younger doing poorly in school, and the mother or whoever wrote that question to you noted that the younger child who was doing more poorly was probably brighter. Do kids use academics as a way of fighting siblings?
The slant is a little different, Gil. I think what motivates the differences between kids, in addition to all the other influences, genetic and environmental, that makes them different, is that a younger child will often back away from the strengths of the older child. If the older child is a strong student and makes straight A's, and everybody talks about that, unless the younger child has a great deal of confidence, he's not likely to take on the older child in his area of greatest accomplishment. So he'll have nothing to do with school and will be a C or a D or in some cases a failing student because he doesn't want to be the same. He wants his own identity. If the older child is a great athlete, sometimes the younger child will avoid athletics altogether and go into music or something else. Now, that doesn't always hold. And here again, we get into the complexity of the human being and the complexity of children. Sometimes a younger child has the confidence to say, I think I can take you even on that field of honor, and will wade right in there with guns blaring. The more typical thing, however, is for children to take different paths and different routes. And parents say, man, how did I give birth to this great athlete and this great musician, and neither of them is good in the other field of endeavor? And the reason is the child has chosen an area where he thinks he might get some success and some attention without having to compete nose-to-nose and head-on with the other sibling.
Let me guess that it wouldn't necessarily follow, though, that parents ought to attempt to reduce as much competition as possible as a way of reducing sibling rivalry.
Well, I think you want to make sure that one child does not lose consistently. There's nothing wrong with competition. The American way of life is based on it. The free enterprise system is at its heart based on competition, a good, clean competition. And it does not hurt kids to compete with one another, and you shouldn't back away from it altogether. But praise and criticism ought to be rather evenly divided between the children at home, if at all possible, even though some kids are inevitably going to do better in some fields than others. You know, there should be a balancing effect. If you have one child who's a straight-A student and the other is not, look for something in the second child's repertoire that he can either learn or something that you can genuinely praise and compliment, because everybody needs that, yay, you and me.
Another angle or aspect of this matter of sibling rivalry that you've touched on in your book has to do with teasing. And this matter of whether good-natured teasing within a family, parent to child or child to child, is harmful, is it?
Gil, humor plays a very important role in the healthy family and the healthy home. And I thank the Lord that Shirley and I have been blessed with a good sense of humor, both of us. And our kids love to laugh. And because of that, there are times when we laugh at one another. Maybe there's a better word for it than laughing at one another. We laugh together. We laugh with one another. But you have to be careful when you are ridiculing and reducing one child's self-esteem, and the humor is always at his expense, especially if you are laughing at something at home that he is also being teased and laughed about outside the home. If you see it's getting to him, if you see he's not taking it well, back off, because we're very vulnerable to that kind of ridicule. And when one child gets something on another, he can rub salt in the wound to the point that they want to kill each other. And when you see it's gone beyond humor and has become an insult, I think you need not only to back off as parents, but also to see that you do not allow kids to do that to one another. Shirley and I have said that over and over again. We would never allow our children to ridicule one another and make fun of one another, especially in the physical area or with regard to intelligence or with regard to athletic ability, especially those first two. And we intervened whenever that took place, because kids don't roll with those punches very well. And especially, again, if it is over something embarrassing like bedwetting, something where the kid has got this secret, this skeleton in the closet, and he doesn't want anybody to know about it anyway. And then his little brother or little sister announces it to the world and says, yeah, 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 and points in the face. And you know how mean kids can be to one another. Not only should parents not do that themselves, but they must intervene between kids who are doing that.
That's what we were saying earlier in this discussion, that there is natural jealousy that results in sibling rivalry, but we have to be careful not to inflame it.
And it is very easy to allow that good-humored teasing and joking and the events of every day to lead, as I said before, to a hatred that will last a lifetime. At 50 years of age, there is still resentment and tension between two individuals when that hasn't been handled properly at home.
You were mentioning to me before we went on the air today a book that you're reading that's on this subject of sibling rivalry, and specifically you were talking about the fact that the author addresses the question of whether the length of time between your children, 2 years, 3 years between the birth of your children, contributes to or takes away from the matter of sibling rivalry. Comment on that.
The name of the book is Raising Cain and Abel Too. I think that's a good title, and it's written by a physician, John McDermott. He is a psychiatrist. Now, again, this is not a specifically Christian book. I don't believe it's published by a Christian publisher. It's published by Wyden Books, W-Y-D-E-N. But it's the parents' book of sibling rivalry. And it is not offensive to the Christian faith. I usually offer that kind of disclaimer. There are a couple of things in it that I disagree with, but I think that there's a lot of good, helpful information about sibling rivalry in this book, Raising Cain and Abel Too. And he deals in the chapter you were referring to with how you space your kids, whether or not you have them close together or far apart to avoid sibling rivalry. And it's interesting from his perspective, and I think I agree with this, that if you want your kids to have fellowship with one another and have the potential for closeness as siblings, you should space them close together, even though it creates more sibling rivalry in childhood. In other words, the closer in age they are, the more likely they are to eventually have that kind of brother and sister fellowship that you would like to generate. But it also produces more competition. There is less sibling rivalry 3 or 4 or 5 years apart, but they don't relate much to each other. So there's kind of a price to be paid for the closeness that can come, and that price is the competition that we've been talking about. Let me read you his concluding paragraph. 2.5 to 3.5 is probably the best age difference if you want to avoid those extremes and still give your children the experience of being brothers and sisters, which leads to a closeness that lasts throughout life.
Can you talk for a moment about how all of this overlays with the discussions we're into these days with our listeners of the compliant versus the strong-willed child? You have to be careful, I would imagine, not pointing to the compliant nature of the child as an attribute in the face of the strong-willed child who you're always riding.
That's true, because that's another natural source of conflict between kids. You know, you're always on the strong-willed child, and you're riding him, and you're pointing your finger in his face, and you're disciplining him, and he looks over at his sibling, I called in a film series Little Goody Two-Shoes, and there's natural warfare between them. So that is another one of those sensitive nerves. But let me remind you of something. This was pointed out to me by a listener the other day. The prodigal son was the strong-willed child. He said, "I'm going to have it my way. Give me my money, Dad. I'm leaving." And the elder brother was the compliant child. He stayed home, and he did what Daddy told him to do, and he worked in the fields, and he did not run away, and he didn't blow his money. And yet the elder brother had many attitudes that made him just as sinful and just as culpable as the strong-willed child who ran off and did wrong things. There's more than one way to sin.
That's interesting. That story is a classic portrayal of those two temperaments, isn't it?
It's all through the Bible, Gil. Look at Joseph and his 11 brothers. Joseph did well. Joseph was loved by his father. Joseph was given a coat of many colors. Joseph was the fair-haired boy, and the other 11 hated him, or at least the other 10 hated him, and they resented him because of the relationship with the father. And I think Jacob, his father, made a bad mistake in the way he related to Joseph. He did precisely what I'm talking about. He showed that favoritism by his gifts and by his attitudes, and he leaned toward Joseph, and the others were resistant to that, and it angered them, and it made them want to kill him. And we can make our kids want to kill one another if we're not careful.
All right, then, rule number one for reducing, maybe not eliminating, but reducing sibling rivalry is don't inflame the natural jealousy of children. Let me go on to a second one and get your comments on it. You recommend to parents that they establish a workable system of justice. What do you mean by that?
What I was trying to say, Gil, is that the kind of disciplinary control that parents have in the family and in the home is directly related to how much sibling rivalry is going to go on and the degree to which kids are going to hate one another. Because in the same sense that a society requires law and order, a home and a family requires it too. If you and I lived in a feudal kind of system, or suppose we call it the Old West, where there are no police and there are no courts and there's no one to whom we can appeal when we get into conflict, and I can throw rocks through your window and I can steal your lawnmower, and you can put your trash over my fence, and you can steal my peaches, and there are these irritations between us. It is much more likely that we're going to hate one another than if we live according to law. There are established laws. You can't do that. I can't go get your lawnmower, and if I do, there are recourses for you. There are things you can do about it. You don't have to shoot me or shoot my kids. There are laws that maintain our relationship, at least within certain boundaries. And there must be reasonable boundaries within a family, too, because a family is a kind of mini-society. And in the absence of that control and in the absence of those disciplinary boundaries where a parent can say, John, you're not going to behave that way, then the older child is bigger than the little one and stronger and more powerful, and he can beat him up and just make him miserable every day of his life. And the younger one is not without resources, too, because he's smaller, but he can get in when his older brother's gone and break his toys and lose his stuff and spread it around. And when the older one brings friends over, and especially girlfriends over, he can make fun of them and bug them half to death. You know, there are all kinds of ways both age groups can assassinate one another. And it is extremely important that parents hold the reins of authority and refuse to allow this kind of hostility to manifest itself.
You were referring to the Old West, and I'm beginning to see the linkage you're describing there. The reason there was so much violence and the reason there was a Boot Hill in the Old West was maybe because there was not the system of law and order that we enjoy today. And I guess you're saying that can happen in a family, too, where there's not strong authority. There can be just an enhancing of sibling rivalry.
Gil, you have seen homes like that, and I have too, and it really is most unfortunate for the kids involved, where the parents are not in charge, and the kids know it, where one child is just being harassed, something terrible, and he goes and appeals to that authority, you know, he appeals to the court system or the police, and they don't do anything. They don't know what to do. And every member of the family knows that they couldn't enforce it if they wanted to. When you have that kind of anarchy, when there is no system of justice and no way to mediate those conflicts that occur, the weaker member of the family can sometimes just be taken apart emotionally. So this is just another important reason for authority, for discipline in the home, and what I've been trying to say for 15 years.
Again, then a parent ought to lay down some laws that are clearly understood and make them stick.
I mentioned before that we don't allow our kids to make fun of one another, especially in a physical or intellectual way. We just do not allow them to take apart the self-esteem of their siblings in that way, and we will intervene every time that starts to occur. There are a lot of other rules that we've established in our home, one of them relating to the fact that our kids are fortunate enough to have separate bedrooms, and there's a lock on that door, and the privilege to enter is granted by the child. I knock on the door, too, before going in. And if they don't want their brother or sister to come in, they can say so and keep them out. We need to get away from one another every now and then. And children spend more time together than they spend with their parents. And sometimes they just start grating on one another's nerves. So you need to be able to allow them to get away. Now, even if you don't have separate bedrooms, you can allocate space within a bedroom. The upper bunk is his, and nobody else can get up there. You know, there's a whole set of these that you can work out in your own home. The important thing is that somebody has to be there to enforce them, and that's a parental role.
And if those are the specifics, again, the general rule I hear you laying down is that there is a linkage between the quality of the exercise of authority on the part of a parent and the amount of sibling rivalry they're going to have to put up with.
That's right. And the homes that I've seen where sibling rivalry is at its most intense level are those where the children do not respect the leadership of the parent, They both know, or they all know, that nobody's in charge, and where the parent is not really willing to get involved and won't mediate, and also where the parent does not believe in punishment, because there are occasions where the law has to have some teeth in it and has to exercise its right to lead, and children will push parents to that point. So those three things are necessary.
Do you see in sibling rivalry some of what you see in other misbehavior on the part of children? You say things that I don't hear other professionals say as commonly, and that is that there is a willful nature in children, and that the hidden message in some disobedience is that they're out to test the authority of parents. Do you see some of that same kind of testing going on in sibling rivalry?
Certainly, that's human nature. Now, I don't want to imply by that that I see kids as sinister and plotting and that we've got to crush them beneath the hobnail boot of authority. But there is this tendency to question authority and to test authority. And, in fact, that leads us right to the door of the third suggestion that I want to hasten to because the program's almost over. And that has to do with the fact that sometimes the hidden target in sibling rivalry is you, the parent. It often represents a way of kids almost tacitly agreeing among themselves, even though they may not say it, to engage in this kind of conflict as a way of getting your attention. Children love the attention of adults. They like to pull them into their world, and if they can't do it through routine conversation or through whining or some other technique, then they sometimes resort to sibling rivalry to get you involved and to hook you and to pull you into their conflict. A father told me the other day they were having a family reunion, and there were a lot of people there, and two of the kids got into a fight, and they were standing there slugging away, and the fathers involved decided that they just wouldn't intervene because it had been going on all day, and they just kind of stood back and watched. And one of these kids kind of backed up a little bit and said, "Isn't somebody going to stop us before one of us gets hurt?" You know, the relationship between kids was changed by the fact that the adults were there.
One of the questions I enjoy asking you the most is to role play for a minute, to actually take the role of a parent who is dealing with children who are really on each other's case. Mm-hmm. You sit them down in the family room, and you're about to make the case for reducing the level of shouting in the house about 10 decibels. How do you put that into words?
Well, let me give the other half of the recommendation from what I just said. There are times that parents need to get involved and need to intervene on behalf, especially of a child who's consistently losing in the conflict. But there are also times not to get involved when you know you're being manipulated, when you know that the kids are really kind of playing a game with you. So let's do role play that. I think it would be wise to sit down with the kids and say something like this. Tommy and Chuck, you guys have been on each other all day long, and I've been wagging my finger in your face, and I've been telling you to cut it out. And Tommy, you knocked over the little tower that Chuck was building, and Chuck, you've been just saying really mean things, and you guys are at each other. And I want to tell you something. All kids do this. I mean, if you go into all homes where there are brothers and sisters, they do what you're doing. But I want to tell you something. I'm tired of hearing it. You know, I'm just sick of hearing it. It's been going on all morning, so I want to tell you something. It's going to stop. You got me? It's going to stop. Now, if you continue to fight with each other in this way, we're going to change the relationship. What's going to happen is, Tommy, you're going to go out and clean the garage, and Chuck, you're going to mow the lawn. Or I'm going to set the buzzer on the clock, and you're each going into your own rooms, and you're going to take a nap. You're going to spend 45 minutes in there. Or you're going to both sit in a chair for 30 minutes. But it's going to stop. You can, I think, by controlling the circumstances, lay down the limits and say, I don't want to put up with that anymore. Instead, what parents usually do is get involved in the fracas themselves and do a lot of yelling and screaming, and I'm sick of hearing this, and get all emotionally upset themselves. And sometimes that's what the kids most want. Because children do enjoy, on occasions, get those big, powerful adults all stirred up and emotional. And so you just need to take charge, as in any other disciplinary setting.
I heard you say in your film series that when it comes to getting kids to do what you want them to do, anger won't produce that on the part of the parent. Action will produce it, and the very real awareness on the part of the kid that you are about to move. Sounds like you're saying the same thing.
Exactly. Let me refer in conclusion, Gil, again to the book Raising Cain and Abel II by John McDermott. And I think this book can be helpful to people. It's a secular book, but I think there is some constructive advice about sibling rivalry in it. And at the back of the book are 28 myths and realities, little short statements that people often believe about sibling rivalry, but which, according to the author, are not true. And let me share a few of those. Myth, brothers and sisters should naturally love each other. Reality, maybe they should, but they don't. When they're young, they're naturally selfish. Everybody wants to be boss. Each one wants more than the others, more toys, more desserts, and more of you. They want to be first, number one, and it's not very attractive, but that's the way it is for some time. It's the number one gripe of parents in this country. I heard some parents the other day that say that their kids fight over absolutely everything, and the mother served them green peas, and the kids sat there and counted the number of green peas that each one had to make sure that one didn't have more than the other, and neither one even liked green peas. Number two, myth. Everyone else's children get along so well. Reality, it only seems that way. As parents, we're over-involved with our own kids. They're an extension of ourselves, and when they're hurt, it feels as if it's happening to us. That's why we exaggerate the fighting of our own kids. It's embarrassing to us, and we minimize it in other families. Here's another myth. They'd stop fighting if I could treat them all equally. Reality, it makes no sense to treat all your kids equally because they're all different. Physically, in age, and emotionally. You like them for different reasons, and when you dislike them, it's for different reasons. The most important thing is to try to be fair. Parents really fall into a trap here, and the author makes a big point of it, that if you try to treat a four-year-old like an eight-year-old and be exactly equal with both of them, you're going to get into trouble. You're the one that's handcuffed. The truth of the matter is the four-year-old needs to go to bed before the eight-year-old, and the eight-year-old should work harder than the four-year-old. So you can't treat them all equally, but you can be fair, and you can balance the scales. Another myth, brothers and sisters will be reasonable with each other only if you spend enough time reasoning with them. And I've said through the years that you can only reason so far and then you have to take some action. The reality, young children operate with a very simple attitude that might equals right, both between themselves and their parents. You have to deal with them on this level, but at the same time, help them grow beyond it into reasonableness. And the next myth, fighting between brothers and sisters is the same now as it was 20 years ago. Reality, it's probably somewhat more intense now because family size has changed. In families with four or five children, it was spread around by sheer numbers. Each child served as a buffer for the others. Now in a typical family of just two children, there's bound to be more struggling because they spend more time rubbing against one another. And finally, an item dealing with the issue of spanking. I love to see another so-called authority in the family who recognizes the need occasionally for corporal punishment with love. Myth, never use spanking. It's permanently harmful. Reality, don't spank when you've completely lost your temper, but spanking, if controlled and not used as the first form of discipline, isn't necessarily harmful. Most parents find that they need it at some time or another. Many parents love their children and use spanking. Many don't love them and never spank. They use humiliation, which is worse. The most important thing for a child is to be loved and to be wanted. Everything else comes second. There are, as I said, Gil, 28 of these myths and realities, and it gives you the flavor of this book.
Doctor, as a place to end, you were talking about some of the sensitive nerves in childhood that are the basis often of these frictions and jealousies between siblings, such things as beauty and intelligence. And you touched on physical ability, coordination, and all of that, and you have a note in front of you that I guess is a good place to end today that explains that just a little further.
Yes, a mother gave me this note, Gil. It was written by one child to another after he had lost some kind of race that they ran and obviously resented it deeply. And he said, "Dear Jim, I'm the greatest and you're the baddest. And I can beat anybody up in a race and you can't beat anybody in a race. And I'm the smartest and you're the dumbest." And this was written by the kid that lost, remember? I'm the best sport player, and you're the baddest sport player. And you're also a hog. I can beat anybody up, and that's the truth. And that's the end of this story. Yours truly, Richard.
Your loving brother, Richard.
What makes that so humorous is that the emotions are so poorly disguised. You know, he'd been wiped out on the field of honor, and he came home and he threw up the battle flags and he tried to fire a weapon into the soft underbelly of his sibling. And that is so common between kids that anytime one gets a little advantage, then he's going to try to hurt the other one in some way. Parents have to deal with this, and one of the best ways to handle it is to make it clear to both kids or to all of them that their love for you is established, that your respect is equal, even though they vary in ability and even though they vary in age. Now, that's a real delicate trick, but nobody ever said that parenthood would be easy. So let me just encourage parents in closing that they can reduce the level of sibling rivalry in their home, but they'll never completely get rid of it.